Dr. Gluck, to Marla, and to the entire staff here at Oratora for enabling us this week, Yemir Tzeshem, next week, and the following week. These three Sunday mornings right here at Oratora, thank you so much for being the Achsanya Shel Torah. Rabbi Engel grew up in Montreal. He studied Yeshivat HaRetzion, and then he earned his diploma, which I can't pronounce because it's in a French language. It's lots of pitchfork on top of it. It's in French. And then he studied at Reitz, where he earned his smicha in 2002. Rabbi Engel, for the past 5 years, for those who don't know, Baruch Hashem, we have many from Lincolnwood, Pearson Park, West Rogers Park. For those of you who don't know, Rabbi Engel has just become the Rav here last month after a 5-year tenure, 6 years? Was that?
What? 5-year search.
5-year search. I'm not going there. I'm just a ball of us. He served for 5 years in the Congregational Rabbi in Abbas Acher in Fairlawn in Fairfield, Connecticut. He also taught at the local day school, the Hillel Academy. He served as the dean, and the vice president of Fairfield County's Regional Kashrus Commission, the VKFC. It's been a privilege to have him as our Rav for the last month. We look forward to many more different Torah in the future. Rabbi Tzvi Engel.
Good morning, everyone, and I'm really thrilled to be here today. And I feel like I was just in this room a few hours ago, and lo and behold, we're back. I want to thank Yeshiva University, the Center for the Jewish Future, Yeshiva University Kol Torah Mitzion, for coming here and hosting this amazing program. I've seen it fly in New York. I know Rabbi Brand spoke about how it's gotten off the ground in many places now, and I am thrilled that Oratora is hosting this program here and that we are the beneficiaries of the Kol Torah Mitzion, Yeshiva University Kol Torah Mitzion program this morning, and hopefully many more to come. I want to recognize the presence also, as it did yesterday, of Rabbi Dr. Hillel Davis, the Vice President for University Life at Yeshiva University. Also, many thanks, really on a personal note, to Rabbi Brand, who I got to know only within the last few months. We met first when we were on the East Coast. We went to a restaurant, got together, spoke by phone a few times, and already we have struck up a very nice friendship, and that friendship became more than just a friendship when my things were moved into my home, and unfortunately the previous person who owns the home had forgotten apparently to move his things out. And my Brand was there with me, literally breaking down furniture, packing it up, and helping me schlep things a whole day. And I'm thinking, the Rosh Kol, the Yeshiva University Kol Torah Mitzion, wow, they really rolled out the welcome carpet for me. And I thank him very, very much. And Marich is what he's doing here, and how tirelessly he's working, and the Kolel is working, and the organizational side, and on the side of the Kol Torah itself, to know that there's a Beis Medrash, another Beis Medrash in the Chicago area that is working Yomam Valayla, not only to learn Torah, to stoke the fires of Torah, but also to disseminate that fire in a positive vein throughout all the communities in Chicago. Now to our topic of this morning, without further ado, the shiur is entitled Grave Appeal. If you just turn to the page, the title sheet, you'll see a picture. It's a sketch from the mid-19th century of the grave of David Malka Meshicha. You will note the people standing in front of it who are doing some very interesting things in terms of how they are physically positioned. We'll talk about that, and our topic this morning is the issue of going to prostrate oneself and to pray at the grave sites of our ancestors, of our relatives. Pretty much a week from now, the planes, people are already packing their bags now, the planes are going to be leaving en masse from Ben-Gurion, from Kennedy, from O'Hare, from all over the world, Europe, and points beyond, and we'll be leaving in order to go be with the Rebbe, Zichuso Yagen Aleinu, for Rosh Hashanah. The Rebbe, of course, is Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, And there will be thousands and thousands of Jews who will descend upon this little town in the Ukraine, Uman. In 1999, I tried to get to Uman, and they told me I could not go there in the coach bus with the group that I was with because there was a rainstorm and the roads were washed out. I said, well, you know, when are they going to fix them? He said, it'll probably take about 2 weeks. At this time of year, they said, since the roads are not paved to Uman, the roads get washed out means the roads are gone. So there will be thousands of people who will be part of this cottage industry in Uman of staying over for Rosh Hashanah to daven at what they call the Tziyun, the marker, the gravesite of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. He had a minhag until he died at 37 years of age in November of 1810 that Rosh Hashanah, at various points in the year, Rosh Hashanah, Shabbos Chanukah, and Shavuos, the Hasidim should come to be with him. So lo and behold, even to this day, thousands of people, I am told that it is in excess of 6, 7, or 8, it's hard to get a number on it, 1,000 people descend upon Uman for Rosh Hashanah. It has reached such epidemic proportions, practically, worldwide, that in Israel they have come up with a new acronym for Elul, Anila Dodi V'Dodi Li, right? Ina Liyado, etc. They have a new one. Ani L'Uman V'Ishti Levad. I'm going to Uman, and my wife is going to be alone. And it's just for men, really. And the women will stay home, the men will get on the plane, and we'll be spending the time in Uman close to the Tziyun of the Rebbe. People will leave Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, the holy city, and will travel to the far reaches of the Ukraine, to non-paved roads, in some places, many places that I was in, at least in the hinterland in the Ukraine, the plumbing situation is less than optimal, and they will spend, sometimes upwards, beyond Rosh Hashanah, a few days to spend time at the Tziyun, to daven toward, and next to, and in the face of, and to speak to the Tziyun, to have almost a conversation, so to speak, with the Tziyun. This is not a foreign topic to any of us. You know what goes on in New York with a place that is not ever even referred to at this point as a cemetery or a gravestone. It is called just by the name, the Ohel, yes? And there are thousands and thousands of people who make pilgrimages, Jew and non-Jew, to be at the Ohel, to be at this place, to pass it, to go there. There's a great tzaddik who is buried there, a great Jewish leader, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, is interred there. It is referred to as the Ohel, a tent. And we have many people who have gone. In fact, I am told that in some communities, they receive faxes from that place before the wedding. Not a joke. It's a masim b'chol yom. And that this happens de rigueur, that people go with kvitlach, with letters, and they leave them in the Ohel, they drop them there, they leave them there, etc. There's a whole Torah about burning them, etc. So let's talk, you and me, today, about what the Shulchan Aruch has to say about it, what our Halacha has to say about it, and we will see today, hopefully, an exploration into some of the complexities of this issue, and there are many complex issues that are raised here, and hopefully some practical applications. Let's start at the beginning with timely visits to the cemetery. The Bali Tosfot list two times that people go to the cemetery, and this comes down to us as the halacha. One in the Bali Tosfot and one from the Shulchan Aruch. Just the top of the page, the Bali Tosfot write that at a time of a drought, people would go out to the cemetery, and they write there that that's why on Tisha B'Av people go to the cemetery, specifically Tisha B'Av, because, say the Bali Tosfot, Tisha B'Av is a tani tzibur, it's a day of a fast. So therefore, there's a component of going to the cemetery. More on why you go during a drought in a few minutes. That's one sort of, on the Jewish calendar, the cycle of the year, institutionalized point when people, according to the Bali Tosfot, go to the cemetery. The other time is now, right now, before Rosh Hashanah, that we have this idea, comes to us, the Ramah writes about it, and that is here, the Shulchan Aruch in the text box, top of page 2. The Mishnah Berur, the Shulchan Aruch writes, "Mechatzim stop in Berur Rosh Hashanah." Right? These preparations, a person should launder their clothing, should bathe, etc. Should cut their hair. Sorry, they should bathe, should wash their clothing. Excuse me, and cut their hair. Erev Rosh Hashanah, and there are those who go to the mikveh Erev Rosh Hashanah. V'yesh mekomo, there are some places noagin leilech al hakvarot ulaharbot sham betchinot. There are those who have the minhag to go to the cemetery and there to offer supplications. V'notnim tzedakah l'aniyim, and they give tzedakah to those who are poor. The Mishnah Berurah writes, why? Why do you go to the cemetery? The Beit HaKvarot u'makom menuchat tzadikim. The righteous people are buried in the cemetery. Batfilah nitkabel sham yoter. Prayers are more accepted there. Ach, however, al yisim agam to neged ha-meitim. Person should not put their focus toward those who are deceased. Ach, yivakish me'Hashem yidbarach shi'iten olav rachmim b'zchut ha-tzadikim shochnei afar. That the person should pray to God, not to the dead, but to God, and should ask that Hashem should grant them mercy in the merit of the righteous people who are living here in the ground, meaning they're dwelling here in the ground. V'yakif ha-kvarat, should go around the cemetery, the graves. V'yitain tzedakah kodem shemar tchinah, should give tzedakah before you offer these supplications. V'ein leilich al kever echad shtei pa'amim b'yom echad. Don't go to the same grave twice in one day. Adkan, that's the practical halacha, and that's, if you will, the bottom line. If you have to leave early, that's the bottom line. The Mishnah Berurah brings it to us. But let's explore, firstly, some of the Talmudic bases for other kinds of visits, situational visits, and then we'll try to understand a little bit more about the complexity of this issue, which I'm sure for many of us, just when you hear about it, you'll start to understand a little bit more the complexity and the historical dimension of the complexity of this issue. We will not have time to go off. There are a number of sort of subtopics that branch out. It could be topics in their own right in terms of a conversation, but it won't be within the purview of what we're going to talk about today. We're just focusing on this. So you'll forgive me if you ask me a question. I say, great question, but it's really not within the scope of what we're talking about this morning. So three situational type visits. So far we have twice you go during the year, the Baal Tosfot quote Tisha B'Av, and the idea that a person would go before Rosh Hashanah. There's a minhag to go before Rosh Hashanah. But there are also situational visits that we have records, and sometimes it's prescribed. A person should go to the cemetery and daven at the Beit HaKvarot, daven at the kever, at the gravesite of someone. So three times, and I'll give you the examples, we'll go into them, but just to see it bigadol in broad scope. Drought relief, a person would go for a crisis involving a drought or a communal crisis. Number two, for deliverance from oppression, a person is being persecuted. Third, for the sake of some kind of preventive medicine, the guarding of moral sensibility, and that's an example almost all of us are probably familiar with from a parsha not too long ago. First, in terms of drought relief. The Mishnah in Tanit describes that after a point when there is no rain, there are various institutions that are put in place by the sages in order to beseech the Almighty. Fast days, extra prayers, days of prayer, ceremonies involving going out into the street with the Aron Kodesh, a lot of different things the Mishnah is described, and the Gemara goes into detail about. One of those things is going out to the cemetery. Asks the Gemara, Lama Yotzin LeBeit HaKvarot, why do we go out to the cemetery? Pligi Ber Rabbi Levi Bar Chama Rabbi Chanina. It's an argument to Rabbi Levi Bar Chama Rabbi Chanina, and I have it translated here. One said, why do we go? Chara Maharenu Chashuvim Flanach Kemetim. You know why we go to the cemetery when there's a drought, when there's a terrible crisis? Because we want to send a signal to the Almighty, we are like the dead. So low do we feel now, so much in crisis are we. We're going there to remember for ourselves and to feel a sense of fear, trepidation should grip us, the idea that indeed we are in front of you, Hashem, we are like the dead. What can we say? What can we do? The other one argues, no. You know why we go? We are going so that the dead, those who are interred in the cemetery, the Gemara says, will ask for mercy for us, on our behalf. So my benayhu, what is the practical difference between this and this? I didn't translate. The practical difference is going to a non-Jewish cemetery. Because if the goal is that I'm supposed to get the message, this is how everybody, how it ends after 120 years, so it makes no difference if it's a Jew or a Gentile's grave I'm going to. It's going to have the same palpable impact on me. I'm human, they're human, they died, and... But if the point is that we're asking those who are interred in the cemetery to ask for rachamim for us, then we want to go to a Jewish cemetery. We want to make sure that it's people that we have a connection to, and people who would, if they were in this world, and maybe when they're out of this world, that's our question, advocate on our behalf. We have all been to funerals where, myself included, I have said these words. We say that so-and-so who passed away should be a Melitz Yosher, a Gittabater for the Mishpacha, for Klal Yisrael. But we have to understand a little bit better, what does that mean? And what are the implications of saying it? And are there any pitfalls involved in it? We'll come back to it. Number two, deliverance from oppression. This is not a normative statement, but it's a story that the Gemara tells about this individual. The story that indeed this individual was being oppressed and persecuted, Nabach, by his fellow Jews. It's talking about Rav Yonah, who is his son, Rav Mani Bray, Havu Kametzari Le Debei Nasiya. This individual is being oppressed and persecuted by other Jews. Basically, they're making fun of him. They would mock him, whatever it was, and he couldn't take it anymore. He had it up to here. He was done with these people coming after him. So what did he do? The Gemara says, Ishtatach al Kavra Davua. He went to the cemetery. He found his father's grave, and he laid himself down. It was Mishtateach. He prostrated himself in front of the kever. Amarle, and he said, to whom? To his father. He said, Abba, Abba, Hani Mitzaruli, these people, Tate, Tate, Daddy, Daddy, these people are bothering me, they're troubling me. Yomachad Havu Kachalfe Hatam. One day, the people from the house of the Nasi, these people who were mocking him, were passing by at the cemetery. In Kutkar the Susataihu. Something happened where the hoofs on the horses that they were riding got stuck. They started coming off, coming apart, whatever it is. Ad the kabilu alayed lo kametzaru le, until they accepted no longer to oppress this individual. And that was the end of the story. And the mysterious part of the story, of course, is, well, why did it happen just there in front of the Beit HaKfarot, in front of the place where this person had bowed down? And Davin, the implication here, you understand, that somehow, having appealed to his father who had left the world, now there was an idea that somehow the father had advocated or had done something, it's not clear, where he stopped the hoofs and the hoofbeats of these people until they accepted, okay, we're not going to mess with this fellow anymore. He's got a very good line toward his father in Shemayim, and he's made a connection with them and his father. Number three. This one is familiar to probably all of us. I have the English translation at the top of page 3 if you want to see it there. We'll see it in the Hebrew over here, whatever you prefer. The Torah says that the 12 spies went up together, plural, Vayalu Banegev, through the Negev desert. Vayavo ad Chevron, but in the singular, they came to Chevron. So what were they all united so much that they're all together? Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, they're all together, they're united, it's beautiful. They went. No, the Gemara says, that's not what happened. What actually happened? Vayavo ad Chevron means only one of them peeled away from the group. He went to Chevron. Amar Rav Malamit Shapirish Kalik Matzit Maraglim, that he moved away from the council of the spies. He went and he bowed down, he prostrated himself also on the graves of the patriarchs. Amar lahen, he said to them, Avotai, my forefathers, Bikshu alei rachim she'enotzim atzit meraglim, beg for me mercy that I should be saved from the council of the meraglim, of the spies. And the Gemara continues, Yeshua kvar bikesh Moshe alav rachamim. Yeshua had it good because his teacher, his Rebbe, Moshe Rabbeinu, already prayed for him. Shenema v'yikra Moshe l'Oshe Abinun Yeshua. Very famously, he added the Yud to his name. Ya Yoshiacha me'atzit meraglim. The Ribbono Shel Olam should save you from the council of the spies. V'ana dichtiv, that's why it says, V'adi kalev ekev haita ruach acheret imo. And as it says in the Torah, and my servant Kalev, on account that he had a ruach acheret, another spirit with him. His implication of the Gemara, that what's this other spirit? He went to the Avot. He went to the over there, right? It's an implication. It's not 100%. It could mean simply that it just meant Ruach Charedim. He was like a different person. He was of a different spirit, and he held fast to what was meant to be the case, and not the way it was twisted and perverted by the Meraglim in their report. Rashi describes, therefore, Yoshua bin Nun didn't have to go where he went, where Kalev went. He simply had his bracha already, was protected. Turn to page 3. Okay. Haran, Rabbeinu Nissim writes in the Drashot Haran that the place where people are buried, the place where there is a tzion, a marker, particularly of great people, if you go there, you will find in that place more divine flow, if you will. It's very tricky language. There almost seems to be something there that there is, that he calls the Shefa Eloki. There is something there at the cemetery, in that place where people, Jewish people, are interred, where there is some kind of a more, he doesn't call it a divine presence, but it's something along those lines, called the Shefa Eloki. And he says, basically, that the tzaddikim, even after they die, the place where they're buried retains some element of the divine spark of some sort in that vicinity where their physical self is interred. And he makes the point, and this is just here after the words favored prayers, where he says, and actually that's what the sages taught in the Gemara and Sota. That's what Kalev did. And he knew that he should go there because it's the right thing. The Kivrei Tzadikim have a Shefa Eloki. Shefa means like a flow or some kind of of something that is running. And I just underlined one line there, but you can read the whole thing for yourself if you like. Ki atfil b'makom ahu tiyeh ritzuya yoter. The prayer in that place will be more favored. To find in that place bodies that have upon them already the divine flow of some sort. Okay. So the Ran was supportive of people going to the Kivrei Tzadikim and to find themselves in that place praying and beseeching help from the Almighty. He does not say you should beseech it per se from the deceased. But he does seem to say that at least there is a good place to be praying because of who's buried there. But there are some pitfalls. Major pitfall, of course, is that the Torah prohibits us from actually beseeching the dead. It's an Isser in the Torah, page 3, the pitfalls and benefits of the place, the right-hand side, according to the Shulchan Aruch, based on the Torah, we just read it a few weeks ago, Doresh Elametim, seeking out information from the dead, and we're learning this in Shmuel Bet. We're going to come to, come to some flashbacks in the end of Shmuel Aleph, where maybe something along these lines was happening. Remember, Shaul HaMelech goes to some kind of a necromancer and sort of raises up Shmuel and starts asking him questions, and Shmuel kind of says to him, "What do you think you're doing?" Yeah? Remember? That's the Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet. We came back to it, we were discussing that relationship. So what is Dorash Lamedim? Shamariv Atzim of Alam Beit HaKvar, a person who starves themselves and then goes to sleep in the cemetery. Kedesha Tishra Allah Ruach Hatuma, so that they can have the spirit that is impure come upon them. So unclear, you know, is that is this Dorash Lamedim? A person goes to the cemetery, they're having conversations, potentially, are they talking to Hashem? So we saw the Mishnah Berurah already says, based on earlier sources, you only talk to Hashem. You're not talking to the dead person, asking them for help. Your appeal can only be heavenward toward Hashem. What we have to see, though, is that if you look at what Kalev did say, Avotai, Bikshulei Rachamim. This person in the Gemara described in Tanis was being oppressed. He actually did say, Abba, Abba. He spoke to his father. Where does speech and talking to someone become a prayer? And where's that dividing line? And we'll see now that the halacha is actually trying to negotiate this issue. And we're going to talk about a cultural, historical element of this in a couple of minutes. Larry.
Sorry, I don't understand why someone would want
the idea, the Ruach Hatuma, he's saying it, I believe, in a like derisive fashion, that you want to have a connection to the world that is impure. Well, I only clipped out a piece of the halacha, but yes, potentially. I mean, you might believe that it would, and there's a debate there also, what exactly your intention is when you do this. But certainly, Dorish Lamech means seeking out to know something from the dead. Okay. The Bach, Rabbi Yol Sirkis writes, here on the left-hand side of the page, he describes the following phenomenon, that people... very often, it would seem, this was the minhag, would make, you know, they lived maybe miles and hundreds of miles from the kever of a tzaddik, or from the kever of a loved one. They would make a neder, they're going to travel to another city, And when they get there, they'll go to the basic chorus and they're going to daven there. And Bach has a discussion here where he quotes from Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel, who is a very important person in the world of minhag. I studied with Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. He was very intent on talking about Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel as one of the main people who is a standard bearer for Yehudei Ashkenaz, the Jews of Ashkenaz, of the Germanic period, probably from, we think, somewhere around end of the 13th century or thereabouts. At the end of the 1200s, he was one of the last, and so he was writing down minhag buchen, what people do in various communities, and some of his students become very important people also in terms of writing up minhag. So he quotes from a tshuva of the Maharil, and also from Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel, regarding these kinds of people who go, and he writes, he's quoting them, that they say, "Ktsat hayan nira kedorish elametim." It looks a little bit like they might, maybe, just a smidgen, like they're going to speak to and beseech the dead for something. The Kalev Shinshatel Kivre Avot, he pala lashem b'makam kedusha. Kalev went to pray to God in a place that was holy. Calls it a makam kedusha. Kedei shetihena, here's the underlined lines, and I'm sorry, I did a bad job here with the underlining, so it's not consistent, but so the underline here. Kedei shetihena tefilato nishma'at, so that his prayer would be heard. And that's what Avraham did. Inasmuch as Avraham, the Torah says, went to the place that he had prayed at yesterday, he came the following day. That's in the story with Stum. He went the following day and he stood, El Amakum Sha'amad Sham, the place he went before, Alma, therefore, Shamakum Goren, the place is somehow effective. Or somehow has something to do with the efficacy of the prayer's acceptance. Inami, further, Misha Biza et Hamet, let's say a person denigrated one who was dead. You spoke ill of the dead. So this is the halacha, and this is the halacha at this time of year, but the whole year. L'chvodo mishateach al kivro. Person goes, therefore, decides, I'm going to go to the cemetery and ask their mechila. That's actually the halacha. So zematzinu, that we've heard of. And when Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel is writing, you have to understand that women were not educated like they are today. Certainly Jewish women, I believe, from what I've learned and read, were much more educated than the average non-Jewish person. But women in general were not associated with the great knowledge and awareness and intellectual capacity that they are today, owing to the developments of the last centuries. So he writes, "Ach noshim uvnei odim she'enem yodim ze liyadati halichaton lama." But people, the women and these people have no idea about this, about that you have to focus your prayers to Hashem, not to dead people. I don't know why they're going. So Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel writes, I used to tell these people, do me a favor. I'll be matir your nether. I'll open up your nether. I'll taras nadarim for you. Don't start making the trip. Calculate how much it would cost for you to have made that trip. And these treks were sometimes days and weeks and months to get there. And give that amount of money to tzedakah. It's like you went. And that's the idea. That's Ad Kan Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel. However, says the Bach, however, kvar hichziku b'minig zeh, everybody already has the minug to go to these cemeteries, to go to these places. Ve'ei mocha, nobody protests. Ve'eshel zesmach b'sefer Zohar. The Zohar has upon whom you can rely with this. Specifically, the idea is to bow down on the place of the grave, but to daven only to Hashem, in the merit of the people who are buried in that place. And he writes that indeed, no one should come up against this minhag. He concludes, "English morally no levata minhag zeh." No teacher, no rabbi should come up and try to cancel out this minhag of going to the cemetery. In other words, the Bach basically mitigates what Rabbeinu Chaim Paltiel said, who is quoted the Maharil, and he says essentially, that's the minhag olam, and that's what we do. Just you have to be careful when you go. You're davening not to the person who died, you're davening only to Hashem Yitbarach. The Shach quotes this idea as well, and the Shach seems to agree because he quotes the end of the Bach, just that's on the right-hand side, page 3 still. The Shach writes basically, Vein Isser Bedavar, he quotes from the Bach, right? Shekvar Yechzikub Minik Zeh, Vein Isser Bedavar, there's no prohibition in going to the cemetery. The Chassam Sofer quotes here from the Prima Gadim, where he says that the place where people are have died and where they are buried is like a shul. Since just like a shul, we daven for other people, so too, when we go to the cemetery, we are davening in that place very often. So yofa kivin v'adin imo, it's the right thing to go and daven. He calls it a shul. Very, 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 very strong language. Okay. Now, by the Vilna Gaon and the Soloveitchik dynasty, and if you know how it works, so you know that the Soloveitchik family basically descended, at least spiritually, of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was opposed to these kinds of things. And a related vein, just anecdotally, they say that Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, I don't know enough about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik to tell you if he did the same thing, but that he never went to the cemetery save once a year. He would never go to the cemetery. He ran away from it, never made pilgrimages, not before Rosh Hashanah, he never went to Daven there. The exception was that on Tisha B'Av in the afternoon, after Kinnus were over, and if you knew how Rav Soloveitchik did Kinnus, apparently he went almost the entire day, he would Daven Mincha, and he would go then to the cemetery, to the gravesite of his wife. But he never made a pilgrimage to go see his Zedo, who he spoke about all the time. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was buried in this massive, massive cemetery in Warsaw. And he never made any of these visits. He simply didn't do it. And in the Soloveitchik family, he writes about this in Halachic Man, the family just, they didn't want to deal with it. They simply didn't want to deal with it. And here you have page 4 at the top on the right-hand side. Holiness is rooted and embedded in joy. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. Right? And you shall rejoice in all the good. And you shall be altogether joyful. Joy is the symbol of the real life in which the halacha is actualized. Avelut, mourning, and aninut, grief, however, are interwoven and bound up with that arch opponent of holiness, death. Death and holiness constitute two contradictory verses, as it were. And the third harmonizing verse has yet to make its appearance. The Kativ HaShlishi Yachriya B'Neim has not yet appeared. The Gaon of Vilna, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, meaning his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, his son Rav Chaim, his grandson Rav Moshe, Rav Elia Prozhaner Feinstein, never visited cemeteries and never prostrated themselves upon the graves of their ancestors. They simply didn't do it. The memory of death would have distracted them from their intensive efforts to study Torah. They simply did not want to get mixed up with going to cemeteries, anything like that. On the left-hand side of the page, Chacham Uvadia, quoting from the work of the Vilna Gaon, about a similar idea. Something we said, many of us might have said, last night. We're talking now, mostly today, about praying to the dead. What about praying to other creations of Hashem who are not Hashem? What about Malachim? The Vilna Gaon was staunchly opposed to any prayer that has anything to do with davening toward or with the help of Malachim, of angels. Last night, it printed in the Art Scroll Slichas, and I know in many other Slichas as well, there's a section toward the end of Slichas, Machnisei Rachamim, those who bring mercy in. We're referring there to an appeal that we are making essentially to the angels to beseech on our behalf before the Almighty. The Vilna Gaon says that is patently forbidden. It's forbidden to recite it. He doesn't really explain where it came from. Someone obviously wrote it, but no. And the Soloveitchik family also, and this is personally my minhag as well in this regard, and I don't put it upon anyone else. If you have a different family minhag, I'm like a shul policy, I don't say Machnis Serachim, I simply skip that paragraph. Anything they do with anything that looks like it's praying toward Malachim. I'll give you an example from Friday night. The Vilna Gaon, and he said Shalom Aleichem, didn't have 4 stanzas, he only had 3. He refused to say the words Barchuni L'Shalom Malachi HaShalom, bless me for peace, angels of peace. Because angels don't give brachas, he said. Only Hashem can give a bracha, and we have the koach of tzaddikim, of righteous people in this world. They have a koach ha-bracha. Hashem gave Avram Avinu the koach ha-bracha, and the koach, the keys, in some regard, are given to human beings to give brachas to one another. But a malach? Impossible. He skipped it, he would say 3. And my Rebbe, Rebbe Rosenzweig, from what I hear, he skips Barchuni L'Shalom. Personally, I do say it. There was a question about the Chassam Sofer. In his lifetime, it would seem the Chassam Sofer largely did not say Barchuni L'Shalom. He said in an undertone, and for this reason. But afterward, later on, I saw quoted that the Chassam Sofer is writing that really Chassam Sofer in the later years, he put it back in. People didn't know. He started to say Barchuni L'Shalom again. But to be mindful of this idea that, according to the Vilna Gaon at least, this is an accretion that one mustn't say. I do say Barchuni L'Shalom. It's a force of habit, perhaps. It's a song. I don't know if it's really a tefillah in the sense of mamish beseeching that they should give me a bracha. Maybe it is. Maybe it's incorrect. I don't know. My son learns it that way in Gan, so we sing it that way. Okay, fine. Now for a bit of history. Because you need to understand something about this whole topic that makes this topic a very, very heavy topic. In Montreal, there is a place, it's built on a mountain called Montreal, Mount Royal, and Montreal has on the top of it, or near the top of it, a gigantic Salem from another religion, yeah? Not too far away from Mount Royal is also on a hilltop, right in view of Mount Royal, is, you can see it on the highway when you're coming over the Champlain Bridge, La Belle Ville, the beautiful city, you see Oratoire de Saint-Joseph, the Oratory, St. Joseph's Oratory. Up until the 50s and early 60s, I am told, there would be stories of people who would claim that if you got up the steps to St. Joseph's Oratory on your knees, that you would have a healing. And of course, at the top, there was the requisite, apparently, I've obviously never been, for halachic reasons, never step in there or even on the steps, but there's apparently up there a room full of crutches and broken wheelchairs. And the meister that used to go around, and you understand, French Canada, very traditional, they call it the pure laine, the pure wool, the Catholic, you know, they up until the 50s, early 60s, still had this, where people would come from far and wide to this place, this site of pilgrimage, and on their knees go up the steps, there are hundreds of steps, and when they would get to the top, they would claim that this was efficacious, miraculous, what have you. Now, between you and me, I mean, we understand the reality of the matter, but this was like, it would go around. And obviously Jewish people living in Montreal weren't really thinking, well, this means anything to me. They weren't thinking it's real or anything like that. But the Sefer HaSidim has the following story. In the story of the Sefer HaSidim died in the early 1200s, 1217, lived at a time before modern medicine. Today we understand modern medicine or alternative forms of medicine as a scientific discipline. But there was a time in history not so long ago that this was not such a scientific discipline. It was a lot of guesswork, and the boundaries between medicine and healing and mysticism, or I would say religion and healing, were much more fused. That's one of the reasons, of course, that most of the places called hospitals were actually places that were run by the galachim, the nuns, the nuns, right? Jews generally didn't have hospitals, probably because they weren't allowed to. It's not because they didn't want to, and of course there are many Jewish hospitals, and that's a separate topic. But the idea of the fusion between them, where the line between physical, medical healing using principles of the knowledge of the day on the one side, to the side on the other end of the spectrum of religion and magic and mystical ideas, was a very blurry, blurry line. Very, very blurry line. Extremely blurry. Today we would say maybe the problem became almost le'idach gisa to the other side, that a person who's going in chas v'sham for a surgery, if someone will whisper in their ear, you really should say a prayer. They say, what's that going to help? It depends on how the doctor does. Yeah. So that's, you have to the other side of the spectrum. The person says, I need a good doctor. And if the doctor's sleepy that day, if Hashem, the person doesn't have strength or the wisdom to solve the problem, Hashem didn't help them to do it, you need tons of siyata d'shmaya. We understand this in this room. And then many Jews in the world have had many unfortunate experiences where I said this to somebody who was not so affiliated. They were offended that I would mention that you should daven. Why should daven if I'm sick? What's the point? Okay. Anyway, here's the story from the Sefer Hasidim. A woman comes to him crying, because she says, I have a son who is sick. He's terminally ill. So late 1100s, early 1200s. I have a Christian neighbor. You know, in Christianity, they believe in this thing called relics. Objects that they believe the object itself has some kind of power that is vested in it. Some of this made its way into Judaism. It's not for today's discussion. That's an important discussion too. She says, my neighbor is a Christian woman. My neighbor had a son who had the same ailment that my child has. And the woman got a relic, a piece of something that came from the holy city Yerushalayim, from a certain place there called the very famous church that's there, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Yeah? She used it on her son. She brought it near her son. She put it under his bed. And he got better. Rebbe, we know the halacha is that if first the doctor will tell you you have to eat chazer, you have to eat pig to save your life, you eat pig. You have to do it. It's not kosher ingredients. You don't have a choice. You should consult with the rabbi first, because there's usually, nowadays, at least an alternate medication generally that you can come to. But, you know, chilul Shabbos, anything. What am I supposed to do, Rebbe? Is this avodah zarah? Is it problematic? Well, what should I do? So we don't know exactly what he told her, but we know the next lines are, she offered her son in an akedah. The implication is that she decided, she was told presumably, you're not allowed to take from another religion what they say has some healing. Because she said, my neighbor has a kid the same age, the kid got better. Maybe there is something to it. I don't know. So can I take that object, also put it, whatever it was a stone, it was a piece of wood, but I'm put it underneath, and also maybe my son will get better. I'm not acknowledging their faith, but no, maybe there's something to it. In the Middle Ages, and actually from the very beginning of the founding of this other religion, it was extremely popular to make pilgrimages to the sites of where their Lahavdol, Elfafei Avdolis, Tzadikim, Lahavdol, quotation marks, underline, were there buried. Very popular. And actually, as the word would go around, I'm telling you, this is happening in Quebec up until the 50s and 60s, people would make these claims. Now, in the 50s and 60s already, so Jewish people can contend with it. But what's happening to Jewish people in the Middle Ages who are under tremendous, tremendous pressure, huge pressure from that other religion to join them? And now they're throwing this into the mix. So there are a lot of polemical considerations going on. I want you to understand first, the first thing we started with is that the Gemara already describes, it was our tradition to go mishtateach al kivrei tzadikim. They took it from us. But they were claiming that their places were efficacious. And therefore, alleges Professor Ephraim Shoham Steiner, he's a professor at Ben-Gurion University who wrote several articles on this topic. Therefore, there was a huge polemical concern that if there isn't some leeway in terms of knowing that the Gemara does describe it, what's going to happen? People are going to start going to these goyish places and they're going to start praying there? Hayitachein? So some tried to actually talk Jews out of it altogether. And there's a sefer, we don't know exactly when it was written, it's the Middle Ages, it's anonymous. You'll see why it was anonymous, because the guy would have been, they would have killed him, and they would have killed him in that certain way. I didn't say the word. But they would have come after him with hooks and nails and put him up. Because what he did is he wrote a very strong polemical work. That's all Jews had. History was not looking like it was going to be on our side. The chips were down and down and down, and Jews living in squalor and with nothing, and at the mercy and the behest of the those who were in charge. So the polemical consideration, the Sefer Nitzachon Yashan, there are several of these books in the Middle Ages, and this is actually quoted directly from the article because I did not find the original source. He points out that the people, the Minim, the heretics, he meant the Christians, who go to with the bones and the bodies, and they call them holy, that's why Hashem made them impure. That's why the Torah says over and over again that when you touch the chalal cherev, the mace, the kever, no, whatever you're going to touch, you are impure, to teach us that it's the opposite way. Don't go to these places. You shouldn't be going to these places. Hare tamein umatamin, they're impure and they make impure. Even the bones, he says, of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, all the tzaddikim, all of them, they're all tamei. They're all human beings who died. They're tamei. He says, don't go, you shouldn't be involved. The Torah didn't make exceptions for this one or for that one. For that reason, God hid away the graves of the righteous people, because it is open and revealed before Him that the nations of the world would make a mistake regarding their own dead. And that's why, with regard to Moshe, the Torah's last lines are about teaching us against this idea that the great tzaddik, the greatest of tzaddikim, Moshe Rabbeinu, Olav HaShalom, is buried in a place that nobody knows, to avoid this problem. And then he writes, even though everyone knows, he writes, that the Avot are buried in Hebron, really, nobody can go in there. Why not? Can no one go in there? As I just explained. Yeah. So he was not living at a time when we have what we have today, Maris Machpelah. But the Sefer Nitzachon Yashan is coming out swinging against the idea of going to the Kivrei Tzadikim, because there's an implication here about what's going on in a parallel world, and that's just outside of the Jewish area. So this is a very, very heavy topic, you understand. And if you've ever been to Meiron, to the kever of the tzaddik of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Rashbi, you understand a little bit about the energy of that pilgrimage, really, to go there. And the kever of the Rambam and Tanayim are on Tavaria, and the Meir Bal Hanes, you go to him for this, and you go to Rachel's kever of Rachel for that, and you go to Maaseh Machpelah. There are definitely roots in Judaism for this. But there's a danger that if you take it to an extreme or you daven the wrong way, you have come into a territory that is off the charts as far as the halacha is concerned. 2 years ago, Arutz Sheva had a story that there was a discovery. They discovered the grave of Unkelus Hager. I don't know if you saw this story. It's unbelievable. They discovered the grave of Unkelus Hager. Let me make an announcement. The grave of Unkelus Hager has been revealed. There were lineups. They painted with blue paint on the outside of this little doorway. It was a shanty in Yerushalayim, in the city, in an area that was not developed. It was like a little grassy, well, muddy, grassy area. And they put up, they had this thing there, and they said, "We found the kever of Unkelus Hager." 3 days after, the lineups were already stretching, and people were coming from far and wide and north and south. They announced that the whole thing was a prank. The three guys from a yeshiva. I think they got thrown out of the yeshiva for doing that. As the people are coming out of the kever, apparently they're giving them envelopes, you know, support a yeshiva. And they said they did what they did because they wanted to expose how much this is already getting out of hand with these pilgrimages to the Kivrei Tzadikim, where it's not just a visit to say a prayer at the Hashem, but we're looking this tzaddik and that tzaddik and boop, boop. Okay, that's a little bit extreme. I'm not advocating it, but I'm just saying, this is interesting. You know, without people really examining, is it true or is it not? Is the person really buried here? What's going to happen? Oh, a new place. Ah, Uncle Sagera, can we not? Yeah, so, gets out of hand. Ruvadya Bar Tanura writes that he visited the kever of Shmuel, and he saw a lot of people were there, and even the Ruvadya Bar Tanura is writing, he's not sure. He says people are making claims that they were healed, Jewish people, because they went there, they davened to the kever of the tzaddik. He says, I don't know what to make of it. I don't think it's really making a difference. You know, I once had a conversation with Professor Montreal. He's like the dean of religious studies at McGill University. He's also an Orthodox rabbi. He's musmach from Yeshiva University, Dr. B. Barry Levy. So I asked him, I said, you know, in the Middle Ages, it's so strange to me. Didn't people realize that if you have an ailment and you're looking for a flower that has the same name, that sounds like the ailment, and that's somehow going to heal you? Didn't people realize that that was not really based on anything? I mean, they took the medicine, didn't heal them? So he pointed out to me, he's a scholar of comparative religion, etc., and it's that kind of thing, that probably in the Middle Ages, and probably even today, about 65 or 70%, see, he wasn't going to put a statistic on it, but a sizable percentage of ailments that the average person has at a given time in their life will actually get better if you do nothing. There is a percentage that won't, obviously, and I'm not advocating not to go for medical treatment if you have something wrong. But he pointed out that on account of that, it's not even a placebo effect. It's that even if they did nothing, if they listened with no medical care, they could still potentially get an ailment and recover from it. They could break a leg. They might not heal well, but they could close itself up in some way. So he said he thinks that's what's going on in terms of the Middle Ages. How come people, Jewish people too, by the way, that's the medicine of the day. That's what they had. Would think about these types of salves, etc. Sometimes, really, they probably were on the mark. Sometimes, they actually really did make a discovery that was correct. But sometimes it was just, we'll give you this, it's a cure for all that ails you, etc. And the line between healing in a physical sense, based on what the doctor tells you and what the religious leader tells you, was a very, very blurred line as such. Let's just look the next page, page 5, because we do have only about 7-8 minutes left. We got started a little bit late. Is the Maram Shik grappled with this question. The Maram Shik lived in the 19th century, passed away in 1879. He says, you know, Taka, maybe it is forbidden to go to the kever of a tzaddik and to daven in any way at that kever. Maybe. I mean, he understands what the Gemara says. But he says, you know, Chazal taught us that you shouldn't call out to Michael or to Gavriel. People say at night the prayer, Shem Hashem, Elokei Yisrael, Mimini Michael. You're not davening to the Malachim. You're just making a statement that the Malachim are around you. Al Roshi Shechinas Keil. You're not saying, and Michael, you should protect me, you should protect me. The implication is that every Jew, when they go to sleep, has Malachim around them who are guarding them, etc. But you're not davening to them. You're mentioning their name. But he says the idea of calling out to them and actually davening to them, that's forbidden. So maybe it should be forbidden to use any kind of intermediary with davening kevri tzadikim, davening toward angels. So how is it that we daven that the neshamas of the patriarchs should daven and should advocate on our behalf? How could it be that there are printed sidurim like this? These are like malachim. You can't daven to malachim. You can daven to a person who died. They left the world. So he writes the following idea, and you can read it in depth for yourself. I must apologize. Something went wrong with the underlining. Chas v'shalom. No one should go home and say, Rabbi Engel didn't like what the Maram Shik said. He crossed out two lines of the Maram Shik. Chas v'shalom. It was an underline. Just got messed up when I sent it to make it into a PDF. So you forgive me, please. Omnam shoresh davar zeh. I'm reading where the underline would have been, but it went a little too low. Omnam shoresh davar zeh. The root of this matter, that people go to the Kivrei Tzadikim and they daven and they say prayers there, and some of them even ask for some kind of advocacy. Who devadai kim lehu lechazach ha-chameinu zichron levracha de-hametim mitzta'arim betzar ha-chayim. The basis for it is that those who have left the world, they have pain when we have pain. That they are aware of what goes on in this world. Kemo shedarshu chachamenu zichron levracha al-pasuk v'yareu lonav la'avotenu. As the verse says, they did bad by us, they did wickedness to us, for to us and our forefathers. Kemo shiviu maisim alzeh, as many stories were brought about this. In the beginning of Perek Mishameit, the beginning of Brachot, the early prakim there. V'ayinush nishmar ha-meitim yodin me'olam hazeh, manasebo, because the neshamas of those who have passed away know what's going on in the world, they're aware of it. And if we have no idea about exactly how that is and how that works, nonetheless, it is the truth and is the upstanding truth according to our sages of blessed memory. So according to that, we have to ask ourselves, if those who are in trouble, who are alive, they go to the Kever Tzadikim, so they're going to say we won't have a salvation if there won't be Rachim Mishamayim. So the people who are buried there, when they hear our tefillas to Hashem, they also have tzar upon our tzar. And he writes that what's really happening here is the following principle. If you daven for somebody else, Chazal teach us, you get answered first. Daven for somebody else, you get answered. Why does that work? Why is that the case? Why should that be true? So he writes, and he gives a few examples. He gives one particular example, that's what happened when Avram Avinu stood before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before Sodom was destroyed. And he said, the line that he said, the idea that he said, Chalil lecha lahamit tzadik im rasha. Heaven forfend that you should destroy the tzadik. You mean a tzadik like a tzadik tzadik. You meant a tzadik, someone who is on the righteous side of the scale, together with the rasha. But who is the tzadik he's referring to? So the Maram Shik believes he meant himself. Again, not that he's calling himself a tzaddik yisod olam. He calls it a tzaddik, that i.e. he is not guilty like they're guilty. That he felt pain that they were going to be destroyed. And he was hoping that if he would say, look, I have pain over this issue, because they are under the thumb of judgment, that Hashem would look favorably upon them by him making that claim. That when Yehuda stood in front of Yosef, he said, I am the surety for my younger brother. I am his bondsman. And having said that I will have the tsar, that all the brothers will have the tsar if you do this to Binyamin, and our father who is back at home will have the tsar, the idea is that there is almost a suffering by proxy, a sympathetic sense of pain. The Maram Shik says, you know what you're doing when you're going to the Kivrei Tzadikim? You're praying to Hashem. And you're saying essentially to those who are interred there, please, have tzara with us. If you'll feel tzara, like we feel tzara, we're not asking you to stand before the Kisei HaKavod and to ask Hashem on our behalf. Because in our religion, we daven straight to Hashem. We don't have intermediaries. We daven straight to Hashem. We don't daven through a human being who's alive and not one that's left the world. We don't daven to Malachim. We daven just to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's toward Hashem. But we're standing there and we're also beseeching those who are interred there, whose neshamas are connected still to the tzion, we're saying, please, feel tzar for me. And by you feeling tzar, there's a surety almost between us. There's a sympathetic suffering that you will feel on high, the tzar that the neshamas feel. And that should be the advocate. The idea that he concludes with is he simply says, this idea that it's understood, the Torah didn't forbid this. The forbidden part is granting divinity to those who have been created. You can't say to them, you help me. Because they can't help you. Because they're not in the world, and even if they were in the world, that's their human power, it's the daven. So that much they have. But to be your intermediary to speak for Hashem, He says, "Militin l'kula shum nivra, afiu l'malach." You're not allowed to do that. "Ulekach asul hipal aleihem shemlitz tov ba'avureinu." You can't daven to them to say that they should beseech on our behalf or should recommend positively for us to be advocates. "Shebezeh notin lehem koach usrarut." Because if you do that, you're giving them power. You're giving them authority. "Lochein hipal kivrot tzedikim." But that's not true for those who daven at the kivrot tzedikim. Why? They should daven for us. You're not giving them authority to help you themselves. Rather, you are confessing to them. You are letting them know. You are bringing them into the awareness of your pain. That they should have pain with you. Through their pain. Through their pain, their zechuyot, their merit, and they have merits, presumably. Going to Kevin Tzadik has great merits. You're davening that this person, you're davening to Hashem that he should help you, and you're saying to this person, please have tsar with me. You don't actually have to verbalize. The idea is you're davening to Hashem in the presence of the kever. The implication is that the person who is perturbed there, who has an awareness of the world, feels the tsar with you and it will serve as a surety for you, a sense of arevut. Kol Yisrael arevim zebazeh, turns out, has, as we know, in many scores, a passage that is not separated between this world and the Olam HaEmes. There is no separation. That's what Kaddish is. That's what the observance of a Yahrzeit is. That's what the Yud Beis Chodesh is. That's all these things. The whole idea of Brei Mezake Abba, the whole concept of it is based on this idea that we might be separated from our loved ones who have left this world and gone to the next world, but our relationship is not severed, that we have no connection to them. Okay. So, V'al Kain, Ein Lanu Mokum Lesser Tefilah Zu, therefore we cannot forbid such a prayer. He goes on, he just points out that you have various people, the Sefer Chassidim made a big deal about doing this, the Ma'aril and the Reb Chaim Paltiel frowned on it. He mentions that in the Sefer Chassidim, the Zohar, they have various Nuschot of Tefillah that have a particular way about them, and they feel that it's okay to use it. He's kind of hinting around that he's not so keen on some of these prayers, where when you see them, and they exist, you can buy these books, they're in the back of some of the Art School published one like this, where it looks very much like you're just addressing them beyond just saying, feel my pain, and be aware of what's going on with me, but you should go up and stand for the Kisei HaKavod. I should tell you that even in the Medrash, particularly in Eicha Rabbah, there are some very, very graphic descriptions about Yirmiyahu HaNavi as the temple is being destroyed, crying out to Hashem and saying, how could you let this happen? Very, very graphic, and I would say anthropomorphic, putting human a picture almost, a description, a language on a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You don't see it to such an extent anywhere else. Where Hashem tells him, go wake up Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and then go stand by the yard and wake up Moshe Rabbeinu and ask them to daven. Etc. etc. So they have that whole talk there with Eicha Rabbah, but it's not a halachic practice. In closing, just need two more minutes to close. I mean that 2 minutes. Rav Meshulam Roth writes, he quotes that it was said in the name of the Chassam Sofer that before Rav Mordechai Banat died, when the Gaon Rav Mordechai Banat died, that he said to the people who were there at his bedside, after I die, anything you need, come to my grave and daven, and it'll be good. Okay. Come to me. Come bow down on my kever. Come visit. Before Rabbi Nachman left the world, there was this idea that people should still have a... He basically said that he would still have a relationship with his Hasidim even after he left the world. And in fact, to this very day, part of what goes on in Uman, I have a family relative who went to Uman 1 year, is not just to daven near the Tzion, but also to speak to the neshama of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and to confess all of one's sins. It's interesting. So the idea of having this kind of relationship. The Abiya Omer writes that, Chacham Uvadia writes that really, while it's true you can't daven to the Malachim, if you're just getting a little bit of help from the Malachim along the way, that's okay. It's the last line. I'm sorry I'm skipping to the last line already, but so it goes. That they should help him a little bit on Malachim. Shapir Ka'avid, that's okay. So the Chacham Uvadia is not as opposed to the idea of saying Machnisei Rachamim, what have you. Again, as I said, according to the Vilna Gaon, Udi Imei, they were completely opposed to this idea. And then you have this whole idea about going to Kivrei Tzadikim or going to family members' graves before Rosh Hashanah. To sum it up and put it a practical bottom line, I think it is worthy for people to go before Rosh Hashanah. Until now it was just the academic discussion. Now let's talk brass tacks or Torah. And I don't speak to people beyond the conference or Torah. Consult your local Orthodox rabbi. Not give him psak for anybody else. I think there's great value and great worth to going to the Beit HaKvarot before Rosh Hashanah. People should go to visit, if they can get there, to the tzion of their the Kvarot of their relatives. To go to see their Avot. To go to Kever Avot. It is valuable to go to the Kivrei Tzadikim. But to be mindful of when this takes on a life of its own that is potentially spiritually very unhealthy, where it becomes a pilgrimage, not annual, but a pilgrimage weekly or monthly. And I've known a few people who have made it into that, a visit. And be careful when you're standing there, who you're really speaking to is a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You're not asking these people to actually stand before Hashem and speak to Hashem for you. We daven direct. We have a direct line. Each and every Jew, each and every human being really has a direct line to Hashem. We don't need anyone standing in the middle of it. And we shouldn't be creating that scenario. To understand the historical implication and the pressure that Jews felt, certainly in the Middle Ages, with regard to another religion, where this was a major, remains a major focus of their religion. And to understand that now, I understand actually that Chacham Uvadia has come out against the trips to Uman because it's really creating problems in the family, where the fathers, the brothers, the sons, they're not home for Yontif because they have to be by the Tzion. They're leaving Yerushalayim to go see Uman. So again, not that it's valueless, but to keep it in perspective and to be mindful, to keep it in balance about when it can become an unhealthy phenomenon. Ad Khan for grave appeal. I'll take one question and then we've got to run. It's a good question. I'm here much too short a time to really have a clue. Sure. But there's definitely value to it. I want to thank Rabbi Brand and the Ecole Torah Mitzvah, Yeshiva Rishi Kol Torah Mitzvah. On this end, I must thank Marla Kirshner for all of her hard work behind the scenes and appreciate it immensely. And Ktiruch Tehima Tova.
Thank you to Rabbi Engel, to Rabbi Willick, who's already on his way back to New York. Please remember Sunday morning, breakfast 8:45, Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Aaron Siegel.